Okay, welcome back to the people in the room and to everybody out there who's listening in. I can see that my plot worked by giving you food right here in the building. Most of you came back after lunch, after such a long and hard-working, mentally working morning. So we're really glad to see so many of you still here in the room, and I promise you that you will get an equally illuminating panel here for our last panel of the day. We have here Richard Befalt, somebody that I have known and admired for many years now. He is the Joseph P. Chamberlain Professor of Legislation at Columbia Law School. He is really one of the top scholars on the intersection of corporations and politics, chair of the Conflicts of Interest Board of the City of New York, which I can only imagine keeps him a little bit busy, and was also a member of New York State's Moreland Act Commission to investigate public corruption, so someone who perhaps understands, like me, what it's like to know what the right thing to do is and have people fail to do it for you in the government context. Jared DeMarinis is the director of the Candidacy and Campaign Finance Division of the Maryland State Board of Elections and is somebody who's really taken a prominent role amongst state election officials, one of the first in the nation to draft and pass regulations regarding the use of social media, internet advertisements by campaign accounts, and political contributions by text message, so very forward thinking, somebody who's really looked at how campaigns are changing. And most of the to the point today, he helped draft the Maryland law that closed the controversial contribution LLC loophole and provided greater disclosure of public political activity of 501c and 527 organizations. And last but not least, Chara Torres-Spellacy is an associate professor of law at Stetson Law, Brennan Center fellow, and the author of the new book, Corporate Citizen: An Argument for the Separation of Corporation and State. Her book explores how, over the course of American history, corporations have aggressively sought to expand their constitutional rights, and American courts, especially the U.S. Supreme Court, often have obliged. And notably for this crowd, Chara was named as a top wonk by the website topwonks.org. So this is a very wonky group, and we have all of these great top wonks here to help illuminate us. Excited to hear what you guys have to say. Richard, lead us off.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, for inviting me here, actually for inviting everybody who's been here. I have learned so much from the prior two panels. I hope we're able to sustain the energy and engagement level of our predecessors, because I think they've been great so far. I want to talk about three things. First, actually, I want to sort of do a little bit of back to basics, which is why does campaign finance law restrict corporate and foreign political activity? Second, talk about Citizens United and its impact on both the justifications and on the rules that it doesn't directly affect, but how it nonetheless, and some of this picks up on themes we heard in the prior panel, particularly from Don Tobin, how it affects things it doesn't directly regulate. And then finally, because I think you put me down as administrative law, and I've been trying to put my administrative hat on, what kind of actions the FEC itself can take in terms of rulemaking to address some of these issues of corporate political spending and foreign influence that have been triggered after Citizens United. So first, what are the traditional justifications for restricting corporate participation in elections? Traditionally, there were two. The first really dates back to the 19th century. There are speeches that Andrew Jackson gave denouncing the role of the Second Bank of the United States in the 1832 election. There were speeches of Lincoln and Hayes and Cleveland, which is the concept later picked up famously in a phrase by Justice Frankfurter, that corporations are aggregations of wealth. That corporations, because of their wealth and power, was seen as a special threat to democracy. And similarly, when unions became more powerful during the New Deal, they were also added into the mix of entities that were, by their very nature, singled out for special treatment. So state laws began to treat corporations as special in the 1890s. Federal law in 1907, our oldest continuing federal election law, is the Tillman Act, which bans corporate contributions in federal elections. And then in the Taft-Hartley legislation in the 1940s, extending that to expenditures and to unions. So number one has always been this concept of corporations as, because of the corporate form, being able to amass distinctive wealth. Second, and I think my colleague Rob Jackson alluded to this morning, is the concept of minority shareholder protection, what Justice Brandeis referred to as other people's money. That you had corporations, and their investigations of this go back to 1905, the Armstrong Commission in New York State, of corporate managers using corporate funds in ways that were actually adverse to the interests of certain corporate shareholders. So the two dominant justifications going down to the year 2010 were that the aggregations of wealth and the protection of minority shareholders. Well, Citizens United, I think, effectively eliminates the first. And I think that's the gist of the court statement that, I won't say corporations are people too, but corporations are not distinctively bad actors. That the fact that they have wealth and power does not make them different from private citizens who have wealth and power as well. That you can't single out corporations because of their status as devices for accumulating wealth. And the court was also pretty dismissive. Some would read it as totally dismissive. I think there might be a tiny bit of wiggle room, but not much, on the argument of that there's that they're restricting corporations is justified in the interest of protecting minority shareholders. I do think you see that concern animating a lot of the effort to get the SEC to take action for greater disclosure and greater corporate management accountability to corporate shareholders. But there is one other justification which did not get a lot of play really until the current century, but emerges particularly in the FEC versus Beaumont decision, and now I think is the dominant one for addressing corporations, and I think Don Tobin alluded to this in the first panel, which is the ease of creating corporations and their ability to use them to circumvent otherwise legitimate restrictions and requirements that would be imposed on individuals. So the corporate form is not just that it's a form, it's not just that it's a source of power, it's easy to generate, and under American law has long been treated as a distinct and separate actor. This justification, the anti-circumvention restriction, really was not at issue in Citizens United. It has been invoked by many courts of appeals in the last 6 years, which have considered and rejected challenges to the bans on corporate contributions, and as I mentioned, the Beaumont case, which predates Citizens United, also used it. It's particularly relevant to the areas in which we deal with individuals, which is contribution restrictions and especially disclosure, because of both the potential and the actual use of not-for-profit corporations and other entities, such as LLCs, to avoid disclosure and perhaps to participate in campaigns where they should not be allowed to. A final factor, which I think is not given a lot of weight, but is relevant to some recent actions or non-actions of the FEC, and is picked up actually in the 1971 FECA, the Federal Election Campaign Act, and the 74 amendments, which authorized corporate and union solicitation on behalf of PACs, is the protection of employees from coercion. Corporations have, firms in general, unions as well, corporations are not only collections of shareholders, but they're also obviously collections of employees. And I think one of the powerful strands in the statute authorizing corporations to participate through PACs was the protection of employees from coercion and threats of reprisal. So I think if we look at the justifications for regulating corporations today, it's primarily about the prevention of circumvention of otherwise legitimate rules dealing with individuals, and I think also protecting some corporate and union affiliates, their employees, from undue pressure to participate in the corporate project. Turning to restrictions on foreign money, interestingly, although you might think of this as very basic, it's actually far more recent. If the federal restrictions on corporations date back to 1907, the actual addressing of foreign money in elections really only goes back to 1966, although where it first shows up tells us a little bit more about where it came from, which was it first began as an amendment to the Foreign Agents Registration Act of 1938. That gives us a sense of why this is there. The 1938 FARA, Foreign Agents Registration Act, was in part concerned, 1938 tells you the time, of the possibility of foreign, particularly Nazi, fascist, and potentially communist subversion of the legislative process through lobbying. And so there was an effort to get greater disclosure of the identities of people recruited to act on behalf of foreigners, initially foreign governments, but also expanded to include foreign individuals. And it reminds me, actually, I was struck by Mace's presentation in the first panel, how much this is connected to issues of national security. The Radio Act of 1912, the telecom regulations and defense. That one, there. I think in the first panel there was some reference to this. This was kind of reflexive, that only American citizens should be participating in the American political process. I think that's maybe part of it, and that is certainly the language that the D.C. Circuit used in the Blumen case, upholding the ban on foreign nationals contributing money in American elections. But I think there's another strand, which is a quasi-national security foreign interest, and especially a concern about foreign governments participating in our elections, often through nominally private entities, because I think it was also alluded to in the last panel. In other countries, it is far more common for business enterprises to be controlled by the governments themselves, whether it's in China or Russia, or the use of sovereign wealth funds through many of the oil countries. So I think you see both the concerns about foreign governments, especially the arms of foreign agencies, and this sense of foreigners are not members of our polity. Well, what does Citizens United do? Well, as we all know, it struck down restrictions on corporate expenditures in our elections and eliminating the two principal justifications, the problems posed by corporate wealth and the protection of minority shareholders. It left in place everything else, in particular the ban on corporate contributions in American elections, and it left in place the anti-circumvention function. I don't want to talk today because it's really not our focus, but the ban on corporate contributions, of course, requires some sharp distinction between contributions and expenditures. And as we all know, that has been pushed very hard through the emergence of coordinated expenditures, which are not nominally coordinated. And it seems to me that although the existing coordination rules are ripe for reconsideration in light of the experience that we've gained from super PACs over the last 6 years, that coordination has to be redefined in a more realistic way. This goes beyond the specific issue of corporate campaign participation, but it is one important way of addressing the possibility of corporations participating through donations, because donations to entities like super PACs and other entities, when those entities act in close cooperation with elected official campaigns, that's de facto a contribution. So I think it's not our major focus today, but I think the agency would be well advised to think about new rules redefining what coordination is. The bigger issue for me is disclosure. Although popular concern with Citizens United focused on the potential for misuse of the potential power of large business corporations entering our elections, I think the real issues have been the explosion of campaign activity by nonprofits, by 501c4s and c6s, which can pool funds from donors and engage in campaign activity, but because their major purpose is technically not electoral, they don't have to register as political committees, and by closely held corporations, LLCs, and dummy or shell corporations, entities which are really there to disguise the presence of one or a very, very small number of people. It's interesting if you look at the history of litigation over the corporate participation in our elections. Almost all the cases have actually involved ideological corporations, nonprofits, not business corporations. The only departure of that is Bilotti versus First National Bank of Boston. But if you look at the major federal cases, National Right to Work Committee, Wisconsin Right to Life Committee, Michigan Chamber of Commerce, Citizens United itself, Western Tradition Partnership, all of the pathbreakers in either failing to or succeeding in extending corporate participation have been ideological entities. That's really where the action is. Now, as we know, C4s and C6s do have to disclose their electioneering communication expenditures, but due to FEC regulations adopted before Citizens United and interpreted narrowly since then, these entities, even if in the corporate form, only have to disclose those donors who earmark their funds for specific expenditures, which in practice means no one. So I think one appropriate response, and because you put me under administrative law, I'm thinking of administrative actions. One appropriate response here would begin to do a new rulemaking, to think through what does it mean to be a donor to electioneering communications. Here is, I think, until now the issues have come up, and a lot of the let's say the inactions, the divided non-actions of the FEC have come up in enforcement actions. And there is, I may not agree with it, but there are plausible arguments in some of those cases that you're making law through enforcement in gray areas. This is not unique to this agency. Many federal administrative agencies prefer to act through enforcement actions rather than through rulemaking. But an appropriate response to that would be actually to sit down and do some rulemaking and to try and figure out, and this, I think, picks up on Don Tobin's distinction, tripartite distinction, but really it's two and one, between, on the one hand, nonprofits and closely held corporations and public and large publicly held corporations. I don't think it makes sense to treat every shareholder as somebody who has donated money to the corporation's political activity. But for nonprofits, which they're to exist solely to collect contributions to engage in political activity, or for narrowly defined privately held corporations, those contributions are supporting the political activity. Now, it may be that some for the C4s and C6s, you do have entities which are not totally electoral. They may not even be primarily electoral. But I think the functional way to address this is not to say it's got to be earmarked, but to do it in reverse. To basically something say something along the lines of, we're going to treat contributions above a threshold. The current law is $1,000. I'm not wedded to that. It may be a higher threshold makes sense. To treat them as donations supporting the electioneering communication unless they're earmarked for a non-electoral fund. And you could encourage organizations that are both electoral and non-electoral to set up electoral and non-electoral accounts. And if you want to give your money to the non-electoral version of the Sierra Club's activity, well, they have C3s and C4s. The non-electoral portion of Crossroads, if that such exists, you give it to that. And if you don't, you're treated as supporting its electoral activity. So I think that, I don't know you're going to get this, but I do think that the current phrase of for the purpose of furthering electioneering communication has been used to hide donors supporting electioneering communications, including obviously corporations. Now, although the D.C. Circuit recently upheld the current rule as consistent with the discretionary authority of the FEC, the language in the Van Hollen case clearly indicates they would support the opposite rule, or at least a strong showing in that language that given the arguments for this and the nature of the FEC's rulemaking authority, that Van Hollen could support the opposite result. So I do think this would be something to do. Included in that is I would have a kind of peel back the onion rule, which is, as we've already discussed, and I think Don's comments earlier, you know, and as it came out in public news accounts the last couple of election cycles, of the so-called daisy chain. Corporation A giving to Corporation B, giving to Corporation C, giving to the super PAC. And I would push for some rule, and I don't have legislative language in front of me, that says that any entity that engages in lecturing communication has to be able to disclose either the humans behind it, maybe call it the human participation rule, or at least the publicly held corporation. I'm not so concerned about publicly held corporations. They exist on record. We know something about them, or a union. They exist on record. It's the Americans for Better Tomorrow. It's the People for Good Government, the meaningless titles, which you can peel back and peel back and peel back. That's the problem. I think it would be within the authority of this commission to basically say disclosure has to mean disclosure, and disclosure has to be the real interests. I don't know. Is there a term for the inside of an onion once you peel back all the layers? The inside of the onion rule, the pith rule. So I think that would be relevant, and I think this takes on something similar with the LLCs. I know the commission was recently unable to take action with respect to treating certain LLC donations as if they were straw donors. I would reframe that to simply say not that the LLC's donation is a straw donation, but when an LLC makes a donation, we should know who is behind them. And that, I think, could be addressed through rulemaking. Now, I may be optimistic as to what kind of rulemaking will actually occur, but I think it's probably a good strategy to at least, for one thing, if a rulemaking is launched, you'll get comments from the people in this room and all around the country, which can come up with, I think, an informed approach to this and to see whether there is something where, to the extent that we are supporting disclosure, that would be more effective. I have actually less to say, unfortunately, about the ban on Farman. I think a lot of that was addressed very effectively in the prior panel. I think, though, one way to begin is to figure out what's there. And I think enhanced disclosure, particularly on the spending of the money behind the nonprofits, the money behind the C4s and C6s, and behind the entities that are giving to the super PACs when it's a C4 that's giving to a super PAC, would at least begin to give us a better sense of the scope of the problem and the modes of participation of foreign entities. So that's one thought. A second thought is to think about to what extent it makes sense to pick up the model of PAC regulation. Because although corporate spending in elections is a new thing as of 2010, corporate PAC spending in elections is not new. That's been legitimated since 1972 and probably predates that a little bit. And there, of course, the law takes a fairly hard line treating any involvement of an individual foreign national in the operation of the PAC, serving as an officer of the PAC, participating in the selection of the persons who operate the PAC, making decisions regarding the PAC's contributions and expenditures as making it foreign. So I'm not sure you want to take as hard a line of that, but you could begin with the PACs. And finally, in connection with this, and part of what I'm doing here, I think, is picking up on FEC decisions or non-decisions that I don't agree with and try to think that they can be redone, is actually maybe to develop a rule that thinks about, that addresses the relationship between corporations and their subsidiaries more effectively. Here, of course, I'm thinking of the Chevron decision and the idea that Chevron and Chevron USA are two unrelated entities, and therefore one of them is a government contractor and the other one is not, when the one that is not a government contractor is wholly owned by the one is, that is. And this, again, was of an enforcement action, and it may, this, I think, as the role of corporate participation didn't matter so much when corporations were completely banned. Now that we actually have to think, now that corporations are in the game, we have to think about who they are, who's behind them, and what are their relationships to each other. And so I'm not sure if this is my third rulemaking or my fourth, and this is going to keep you through your next couple of decades of not being replaced. I think another area for appropriate rulemaking is figuring out what's and there are obviously models of this for other end from many other corporations come up in almost every regulated sphere, labor, everywhere else, is to figure out what's the nature of the relationship between a subsidiary and a parent, between affiliates. That's relevant for the government contractor ban, it's relevant for the foreign corporation ban, and it's relevant generally even for the corporate contribution ban. Stop there.
Thank you.